daughters out there, do you feel that your mothers always criticize? Or mothers, do you feel hurt that your daughters shut you out? Do you both critique each other on the big three, hair, clothes, weight, all the time, really just longing for the approval and understanding of each other, to be seen and heard for who you are? And do you sometimes realize, usually too late, that a remark that would be harmless coming from anyone else causes an explosion when it comes from your mother or your daughter? In her newest book, You're Wearing That? Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation, Deborah Tannen, the linguist and best-selling author of You Just Don't Understand, untangles the knots that daughters and mothers tend to get tied up in. And we'll talk with her about that and about an earlier book, The Argument Culture, which explored why America seems to make everything a battle, a debate, or a war, and what that costs us as a society. Deborah Tannen's You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, was on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly 4 years, including 8 months at number one. The book first brought gender difference in communication style to the forefront of public awareness. Then another book, Talking from 9 to 5, Women and Men in the Workplace, Language, Sex, and Power, does for the workplace what the earlier book did for women and men at home. I Only Say This Because I Love You, another book, does the same in some sense for families and partners, and now You're Wearing That specifically for mothers and daughters. Tannen is one of only three professors at Georgetown who has been appointed to the distinguished rank of university professor. In addition to her linguistic research and her popular writing, she's published poetry, short stories, plays, and personal essays. Welcome again, Deborah Tannen.
It's a delight to be here.
Thank you, thank you. I always like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the bestsellers and the ideas that we deal with on the show. When you joined me on the show before, you talked a bit about some of what attracted you to linguistics in the first place. Could you share that a little bit?
I always loved words. My BA and MA were in English literature, and I was a teacher of writing, and I had lived in Greece for a number of years. In fact, my first husband was Greek. So I had an interest in how people from different cultures talk from that experience in Greece. And although I loved the teaching English, I was starting to get kind of restless, wanted to do something different. I thought about law. I thought about a PhD in English literature. But it seemed a little bit removed from the world. As you say, I do my own writing as well. So that had an appeal. But the word linguistics just always kind of fascinated me. And I went to a linguistic institute, and I was just lucky that that summer they were doing not the more technical linguistics, which is more typical of the field, but language and context, how people use language. And it was just love at first sight. That was going to be it for the rest of my life. It combined that love of language and loving to pick things apart, you know, and see what's really going on, which I had done with literature. But here I could do it with people talking to each other. That was it.
The shift, then, that you made from writing academic work, doing academic work, to writing for the popular reader and suddenly having bestsellers, what was that like?
You know, it's a funny thing. It was almost from the beginning that I wanted to talk not only to an academic audience, maybe because I'd been out in the world, maybe because my own parents were not in that academic world. My parents were born in Europe. My mother never graduated high school. My father never graduated high school, though he also was a lawyer. It's an interesting story in itself. He went to law school at night. So I just knew that my parents would never read the kind of books that academics read, but I knew that they were interested in the kind of thing I was talking about. I would just find myself at parties or, you know, just talking to people, and they'd be so interested. So very early on, even while I was still a grad student, I was sending off queries to Redbook and popular magazines. And then my dissertation and my first book were about New York conversational style compared to California. I had studied a single conversation between New Yorkers and Californians. I was one of the New Yorkers. The two Californians were from the Los Angeles area. And as soon as I had an academic piece focusing on that, you know, I didn't want to send the whole book around, I sent it off to New York Magazine, the New York Review of Books, New York Times, to see if anybody was interested, and New York picked it up right away. So I had my first article for a popular audience almost immediately.
And I know one of the things you said that you used to ask, it's somewhere in the new book you're wearing that, you would ask yourself, would my mother understand this, read this, appreciate this, and so on? And so, am I correct?
Yeah, I always wanted to write things that my mother could read. And in fact, my father would sit down and read my academic articles. My mother would be impressed, maybe. I don't think it meant a whole lot to her. But she wouldn't read that kind of thing. So yeah, part of me wanted to write things she could read and just talk in a way that people like her would be interested in hearing.
Okay, and you're wearing that. This new book grew out of a previous book, didn't it?
Yeah, my previous book, it was called I Only Say This Because I Love You, was about adult family relationships. And the reaction that I got to the book, both in frequency but also in passion, disproportionately focused on the mother-daughter relationship. In fact, the title, which I didn't think was particularly mothers, many, many people did hear their mothers say, I only say this because
I
love you.
Oh, right. You meant it for any sibling, partner, all of that, but people heard it in the mother's voice.
Right. And it does kind of capture what became one of the central conundrums of that relationship, that mothers do see as their job being helpful, taking care of us, being protective. But anything you do in that vein always implies criticism. If you weren't doing something wrong, you wouldn't need that advice, help, or protection.
Right. And so we have, and the other thing I would think is that while a father may feel that his role is to protect and to care for and so on, he's unlikely to do it nearly as much in conversation. So with a mother-daughter, you have both the fact that women tend to communicate in conversation more than men, especially about personal things, and then that caring gets expressed that way. And as you say, you're wearing that can almost never be heard as a neutral question, right?
Yeah, it's so true. I talk about the big three, hair, clothes, and weight. So you're wearing that could stand for any comment about appearance. Hey, it's daughters turning that same critical eye on their mothers as it is the mothers on the daughters. Women are judged by appearance, and mothers and daughters feel that the other represents us to the world. Mothers in particular do get blamed if their daughters appear unacceptable in some way.
Right, and lest anyone think that it's just about the big three, it really goes into life choices, career choices, relationship choices, and just how, in some ways, what the book is for is for, I think, those instances where these two adults are speaking somehow out of their first relationship as a child and a parent, right?
Yeah, quite right. It's about much bigger things, as you're saying, life choices, how you raise your children, it becomes very loaded, your choice of partner, lifestyle, all those things, and also tiny things. A conversation that I cite where a daughter was making a salad and her mother said,
yes.
Put a quarter of those tomatoes. She said, something wrong with that? Oh, no, just that personally, I would slice them. And the daughter's thinking, can I do anything without my mother telling me to do it another way?
Right.
So it's the big things and the little things. And you put your finger on it. It's this feeling that we think we're having a perfectly lovely conversation and then suddenly somebody says something and feelings are hurt. And then when your feelings are hurt, you snap, and then the other person's feelings are hurt, and each one thinks the other has introduced that note of contention into the conversation. Because no matter how old we are, we want to feel that our mothers think we're great, maybe think we're perfect, even though nobody's perfect. And in a way, daughters are the only ones who can give their mothers the final stamp of approval that she was a good mother, which mothers all worry about it.
Right. We're wanting our mother's approval, and they're wanting to know they did a good job and that they did it right. Let me ask one or two last questions about that and then move to the argument culture, which I think has so much to say about what's going on in this country right now to our detriment. Your own mother died during the writing of this book, and you write about how you spent more and more time with her as she grew weaker. And how did that experience influence your writing of the book, if not the content?
The major writing I actually did after she had died, and I think my emotions were much closer to the surface. The importance of that relationship was just so present and real to me. So I think it enhanced the book in that way. Another thing it did was I was someone who had had a lot of, you might say, I would almost say I was at war with my mother, except that I don't want to use war metaphor. We struggled when I was younger. And so in the book, I put quite a few examples that I had told over the years where she talked in ways that I was critical of. When I had told those examples to my friends, I could always count on them to look at it from my point of view. But when I put an example in a book, I always have to show both speakers' points of view. And so it really forced me to look at the same conversations as my mother might have looked at them. And it so helped me understand her motives and what could have been her motives, and took away some of that resentment and anger that I felt at the time.
So, in other words, the writing of it, given the timing of it, really, it sounds like, I mean, from what I read in the book, that the experience of caring for your mother transformed your relationship towards the end. But my guess is the writing of the book transformed your understanding of the relationship.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. Many women, as their mothers age and they do a lot of physical caretaking, we come to look at our mothers in a new way, because I think just that physical contact and the act of taking care of another person in that basic way, you're filled with a kind of love that I don't think you feel in other contexts. And it's quite a bit, I think, like what mothers feel taking care of young children. The mothers and daughters often are physically closer than father-daughter, father-son, mother-son, for longer. I mean, after you're not an infant anymore, we might walk, you know, closer and hold hands and make these physical gestures. And I think that's an analog to the verbal closeness. This is something that came up when I was writing the book, You Just Didn't Understand, that women and men often can walk away from a conversation having focused on different elements. Whenever we talk to each other, we're negotiating how close or distant we want to be, as well as, you know, if there's a conflict, who's more likely to step away, you know, who kind of has more power. And they're both always there, but women seem to focus more on this constant question, are we close, are we distant? And when I talk to women about their mothers and daughters, every single one, almost in the first sentence, talked about, we're closer, we're not close. I want to be closer, but closer than I was to my own mother. And I think that physical closeness is all part and parcel of that. And it's one of the things that makes the relationship so rewarding. I mean, we have to keep in mind, these are the best conversations, as well as sometimes the worst. The feeling that you can tell her anything, that she's interested in anything about your life. One woman said, who else can I tell I got a good deal on toilet paper? This is someone who cares about things, details, as much as you do. So it's both a wonderful part and introduces that level of risk, because they're so close, what the other one says really carries a lot of weight.
Absolutely. Let's turn now. I want to turn to an earlier book of yours, The Argument Culture. I have read your stuff for years, but this is one that I think, unlike the others, which all are about one-on-one kind of, this one really looks at the whole, what's going on in our society. And I'm just going to read one paragraph of something you wrote about the argument culture and then ask you to expand a little bit, and then I've got some specifics. I also want to tell people that part of what led me to bring this up today is I saw Thank You for Smoking last night, a new feature film based on the book by Christopher Buckley, and the lead character is a lobbyist, a spinmeister for the tobacco industry, and very much the film is about argument and how to win an argument and how to never get caught on, you know, what the facts might be or what the reality might be if you're good enough at arguing. And so this is a paragraph. The argument culture rests on the assumption that opposition is the best way to get anything done. The best way to discuss an idea is to set up a debate. The best way to cover news is to find people who express the most extreme views and present them as both sides. The best way to begin an essay, and you refer how this is perpetuated in academia, is to attack someone or someone's ideas. The best way to show you're really thoughtful is to criticize. The best way to settle disputes is to litigate them, and you also deal with that. That book was several years ago. Either expand on what I just said or what has come to you over the years about this.
You know, when I wrote that book, I had these delusions of grandeur that actually things would change because I described it. And it did get quite a bit of attention from journalists who, not all of whom are happy with that, what I call agonism, using that warlike approach, but they don't really see a way out. But I see it around me all the time. It's still very, very much with us. You know, it seems so self-evident at first blush to Americans. Oh, of course, a debate. Let's debate. That's the best way to learn something. It's not the best way to bring out the nuances, the complexities that are there. And often it means that people who don't have those extreme views feel left out of the conversation. They feel there's no place for their view, and they often turn off. The audience for these shows like Crosstalk on the cables is actually pretty small, the small number of political junkies. But the people who, the majority of people quickly get turned off because of all the yelling and because the information is so confusing. Global warming is a perfect example of that, because the producers think that they must always have two sides, and even the press, print journalists, feel you should always present the other side. Right after they tell you about all the scientists who believe global warming is a significant problem, they will quote those who say it's not. And you don't see that the ones who say it's not are a tiny minority. And often it's research that was funded by the fossil fuel industry.
Yes,
but
one of the things...
presented as two sides.
Right.
But thinking, well, who knows what the truth is here?
I've spoken to journalism professors and journalists, Mark Danner, I've had on the show a few times, about this issue, that this idea of balance is actually, it's like a crude instrument, and it deters from information because, as you say, the press's way of doing most things is one side, the other side, we'll leave it at that, which they claim is balance. One of the other things we saw, global warming is one, but in the lead up to the Iraq war, basically, since the Democrats were not willing to take a strong opposition position or question as hard as they might because they were afraid of how that might be perceived, the reports became, they went for one side, and journalists have told me, if the other side had said something different, I'd have reported that too, but since they weren't, I only reported the one.
You know, sometimes the Democrats are, I think you're right about that, but sometimes the Democrats are saying things and it doesn't get reported because it's not punched up. It's thoughtful. It's roundabout. It's nuanced. It's complex. Politicians catch on really quickly that if they want to get on the evening news, they should insult somebody. That's what gets on.
Another thing that you point out in talking about the argument culture is, not only do people feel left out if they don't have an extreme position, but the very approach is not likely to lead to solutions or to learning. I moderate panels at times, and I always say to people, I want everyone on this panel to learn something new today. I don't want you just to repeat what you already knew so that there's something here that wasn't here before.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. When you have a debate format, you can't acknowledge when your opponent comes up with a good idea. You can't bring forth any ideas that you think of which might support the other view rather than your own. So all kinds of information gets suppressed. The goal is to win the argument. And we see this in classrooms, too. If you set the question as, this article you've read, what do you see wrong with it? You're going to get certain kinds of information, yes, but all other kinds of information may not come out, like how does this relate to all the other things we read? What should we know about the background of this approach to understand why the author would have said this? There are so many nuances, so many ways of integrating ideas other than fighting over them.
Yeah, one of the things I notice is that, as you were just saying that, I was thinking, boy, if the U.S. public and perhaps the media as well, could be educated a little bit in what gets lost in this. One of the things, I saw an article recently that pointed out something which I have noticed a lot in the Bush administration, which is they use very often the straw man. And the straw man is a way to have an argument even if the other side isn't there, right? In other words, Bush will say there are some who believe that we shouldn't be investigating terrorist organizations. There are some who believe we should just get out tomorrow. And these people that don't necessarily exist and who aren't named are basically the 180-degree argument from his position. And he says, as if your choice is only between those two.
It's so true. Because we're all used to thinking about things as two sides, we put everything into that mold. And it also means that information that shouldn't even be out there can get out there because it's masquerading as the other side of a debate. Holocaust deniers are a good example of that. They've had more success in the United States than anywhere else because they can masquerade as the other side. And I have examples there of producers who, when they are, for example, Deborah Lipstadt wrote a book about deniers. She was invited to be on a TV show, but they wanted to invite the deniers to debate her, which, of course, would give them
equal standing.
A forum that they shouldn't have because there's nothing to debate. It happened.
Right. What's so sad in a democracy, and you quote John Dewey, democracy begins in conversation, is that in this debate, would you rather that or this? And most people will find themselves going to one side or the other, but in fact, any solution that's going to work for society, that's going to work in Iraq, that's going to work with Social Security, that's going to work with healthcare, that's going to work with global warming, is going to be some better fashioned new idea that is neither A or B.
Part of the problem is that we have this 24-hour news cycle. Nobody really has enough time to put together the shows or write the articles. They're all running to stay in place. It's very easy to put on a show with getting two people and let them fight with each other. And there's a feeling that you might lose the audience if you don't keep it at that level.
And as you're, as you're saying,
rancor, there was just an idea that it's fun to watch fights.
The journalist has to do very little research.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's easy and you don't have to think too much. Cross-cultural contrasts are often interesting. I had a student who studied talk shows in Japan, and she found that it was quite unusual for a show to have two experts. They would have one or they would have more than two. In fact, one that she studied had 13. Can you imagine us with that? And having two makes it tempting, first of all, to put the extreme views in those two slots and also for the two who are there to stake out opposing positions. And, of course, that's a war metaphor right there, staking out the positions.
Exactly. Exactly. Let me just ask one last question, which is that another thing you talk about in the argument culture is the litigious society. And you actually point out, I know one wonderful example is that in putting together your book on business, Nine to Five, when you made confidentiality agreements with companies, when you were able to do it kind of off the cuff, it worked great. But whenever the lawyers got to work, you never succeeded in getting one.
Yes, this was so frustrating. There were several companies. The deal was that I would go in and tape people. They would tape themselves, and then I would talk to them and talk to the people that they worked with and shadow them, and it worked quite well with the companies that I did work with, and that's how I got the data for the book. But there were several companies that were ready to go. They had identified the people who had wanted to participate. Everything was all set, and they said, okay, we'll just have our lawyers draw up a contract. Well, they had a lawyer, so I had to get a lawyer. And each lawyer's job was to assume that the other one was going to be out to get them and built in all kinds of checks against things that were never at risk. For example, in the end, their lawyer wanted the right to reject my entire book. I was quite happy to let them see everything that came from their workplace, and I never publish things that I haven't shown to the people who participated, and if they feel it's not accurate or if they don't want it out there, then I don't put it out there. But they wanted to be able to reject the whole book. I mean, that's an example of how extreme it got because of the lawyers making it into a war.
Okay, we're going to bring this to a close. The new book is You're Wearing That, Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation, and it is just the latest in a series of books that the one thing I think is sort of sad is that when you said you thought that the argument culture might actually contribute to a shift, I think it's because the earlier books or the books about interpersonal communication seem to do that. People write and say, I've learned, my spouse has learned, we're communicating better, but society wasn't quite that. The website is deborahtannen.com. That's Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H, Tannen, T-A-N-N-E-N, one word, deborahtannen.com. Thank you, Deborah Tannen. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You were great to talk to.